Good afternoon. It is September the 6th, 2018. I'm at Belknap campus at the University of Louisville, and I'll be talking with Carol Seifer. She had done an earlier interview with me back in August. I'm Tom Owen, as you recall, if anyone's listening one interview after another, we talked about the graphic arts in Louisville and her relationship to her brother, who a prominent graphic artist, Julius Friedman. So, Carol, let me go back to something I know we touched on in the earlier interview, but just to kind of get my brain organized and maybe a listener as well. You were married to a physician. You had two daughters, as I recall, at St. Francis of Assisi School.
St. Francis.
We're
with the Episcopal.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. St. Francis School. And at that time in your life, you began working, you thought, for a short time, part-time, perhaps, with your brother, Julius, at his studio there on Hampden, H-A-M-P-D-E-N, place. Did he wave a red flag? How did this happen? How did you get involved?
One morning, there was a knock on my door at home, and there he was, which was rare. Mm-hmm. And he said that his partnership with Franklin Ross had ended, and he needed a part-time secretary until he could find someone to fill the position. And so I said yes, as long as I could be home when the kids were home. Mm-hmm. And he said, fine. And I continued to work for him until he got married.
Okay. Say again, for the record, that period of time. You walked in the front door to as a secretary helping him, and that would have been what year about?
Let's see. Melissa was in the second grade. She was born in 73, so she would have been seven. So I guess it was 1980.
And you worked with him steadily until he married, which would have been in early 2000s, you think?
Yeah, the early 2000s.
Early 2000s, okay. The distress signal was his knocking on the door, saying, Carol, I need some help. What kind of help did he need?
Well, back then you didn't have computers, so we had a ledger which had all the categories of expenses. So I kept that ledger, and then I wrote all the letters that needed to be written. Eventually, I did all the taglines for the posters, and he would continuously ask my opinion on which photograph to use for a poster. And then we happened to luck into the fact that poster art became very, very popular, and I began wholesaling his posters all over the world. And by wholesaling, I meant you would have to buy 100 posters at a time for each image. So I continuously did that, and then we accumulated extra money. So I knew he would not do anything but put it in a CD, and these were the Carter years. So I began investing, because in the Carter years, if you had to borrow money, you were in trouble. But if you had money, you were in hog heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Because interest rates were high, municipal bonds, AAA rated, 10.5%, non-taxable.
Mm.
So I just invested all this money.
Mm-hmm. And so there was, so your role evolved.
Right.
Financial manager.
Yes.
No question ever that you were investing his money.
No, there was no question.
No question about that. And he seemed pleased with some of the results.
Oh, yes. He was very pleased with the results.
And at the same time, you were doing kind of secretarial work initially. And then talk about a little bit of that. Carol, I've got several images here. I know what the project is. Obviously, I've been working on it. Look over my shoulder. Talk a little bit about that dynamic.
Well, back in those days, you took slides. And we had a huge light table, and we'd sit the slides on the light table, and with a magnifying glass, we would go look at each slide and decide which image would be the best. Like, for Unbelievable Color, the one with the gumball machine with an egg in it, he shot two different gumball machines. He shot a red one, and he shot a green one, and we thought the red one was better.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. He would say, look over my shoulder, or let's look at the light board. And when you say writing captions, is that the word?
Well, it's taglines.
Taglines, yeah.
Like, I came up with the idea of Unbelievable Color, which was a series done for the Hennigan Printing Company. And there was probably four or five different posters that we did. And that's what I mean by taglines.
I see. Talk about that worldwide marketing. I just don't have a picture of that. Somebody's going to buy 100 posters?
Well, back then, you didn't have digital art. Nobody mm-hmm. had a telephone in their hands. And there was a convention every year in New York for poster art. And mm-hmm. poster dealers would be there from all over the world. The farthest place I ever sent anything was Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And we showed them what we had. And people began calling. And we began shipping.
See, I hear that, but I hear Louisville Ballet is going to be written at the bottom of the poster?
Yes. A perfect interest. There was a TV show, and I don't remember the name. Well, actually, there are two TV shows. One of them showed the Louisville Ballet poster
mm-hmm.
in the set,
mm-hmm.
and one of them showed fresh paint.
Mm-hmm.
So they were used commercially, but they were used, people just bought poster art. If you couldn't afford to buy, in quotes, fine art,
mm-hmm.
or photographic art, fine art, a poster was an easy way. You didn't even have to frame it if you didn't want to. You could pin it on the wall to decorate your dorm room, your hat, whatever.
Well, along the hallway to the bathroom in some restaurants, and even
yes,
in the bathrooms themselves, there will be an exhibition poster.
Right.
If you go in Paris or somewhere. Yeah.
If you go to the Bristol on Bardstown Road,
mm-hmm.
and on the balcony seating area, you'll find a lot of his posters.
Hmm.
He did a poster for Porcini's, the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
It's in their restaurant. People just, that's what they bought.
Mm-hmm.
It was affordable art. And of course, I'm biased, but he produced beautiful imagery. In fact, in somewhere I went on this floor, mm-hmm. there's a Roy Stryker poster.
Mm-hmm.
He did that poster.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So how did you tell people this stuff was available, because you didn't have a website?
No. It was really word of mouth. There were several big poster distributors, and mainly we sent to those people. Then we would have, you know, the occasional person who wandered in the studio and wanted it. And then for every charity auction, people would want posters.
Did you produce a catalog ultimately? No. Where somebody could leaf through a catalog and say, a dealer, and could, no.
We never did.
Never did a catalog?
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope.
But just word of mouth, and ultimately, I guess, you had a website.
No, we never did.
Oh my God.
We ultimately have a website now. Mm-hmm. When it became digital, mm-hmm. he's always had a website, mm-hmm. Images. Mm-hmm. And on that site, you can see his photography and you can see his posters. Now, if you were to buy one of his photographs, it's obviously a lot more expensive, because it's like in series of 10 only. Mm-hmm. But you could buy all of his posters if you wanted to.
By extension, at this very moment in our discussion, are you continuing to do that role of providing poster art for dealers or whomever?
What I'm doing is I started in the process. His website is still up. In fact, I got a poster in my car that I'm mailing today. It's still up. The images site is still up. So people email the site and I get the email and then I can send them the post. They have to send me the money, I send them the poster. But my ultimate goal, and we're in the home stretch, I'm starting the Julius Friedman Foundation. And when that website goes up, you can buy online. The money will go into the foundation, which will give a $10,000 grant every year. The first grant will go to the Leukemia Society, specifically for the type of leukemia he died of, which was AML. And then after that, it will be either a high school or college person in the arts field will get $10,000 to use for their education. Or if they're already an artist, to use for them to produce an article of art.
Who's going to be the referee, the gatekeeper for that process, just out of curiosity?
Well, there's me, and there's two men, Tad Bussey and Chris Klonoski, who are two people who work for the University College Design Association. They used to be out of Chicago. Julius met them years ago when they asked him to do a photographic workshop. It would be a weekend workshop. And he did many of those workshops all over the country for them. They all came to his funeral. Mm-hmm. He was very close to the whole group. And the two gentlemen I just mentioned asked me, would I be willing to do the Julius Friedman Foundation? And my whole goal with my brother's sudden death and untimely death, I mean, death is untimely no matter when it was, but he was only 74, which to a college student seems old, but it's not.
Yes, of course not.
I want to keep his name out there, and I want to take the money that he left me to give to other students, because my brother loved to mentor young people, or anybody that was in the arts field. And I thought, this is a way to keep that process going without him being here. So when that website goes up, you will be making a tax-deductible contribution, which will go straight to the foundation.
Even if you buy a poster?
Even if you buy a poster. Everything you buy off of that website will go to the foundation.
Mm-hmm. I see. Back to the management question, it just occurs to me, there are a couple of aspects of that marketing distribution of posters, an extension of the creative business, obviously, and that is the whole licensing copyright stuff. Did you wallow in that?
Well, we have seven copyrights, which the lawyers for the university, when I gave everything I had to the archives, mm-hmm. were in a tizzy about. Mm-hmm. And I told them that upon my death, those copyrights expire. Mm-hmm. We ran into someone ripped off the Fresh Paint poster. They did a poor job. They put bagels instead of eggs. And we hired an attorney. I don't even think that people were in, I don't know, but can't remember if they were in the United States or not. But anyway, we sued them and won. And from that point on, there were certain posters. We didn't copyright mm-hmm. everything, but there were certain posters that are copyrighted. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So.
So that you didn't have those kinds of challenges when in that almost 20-year period when you were working closely with Julius.
We only had the one case.
I see.
That was it.
I see. Okay. And think of a in that period when you were daily involved working with your brother. What was a typical day like?
Well, we always, well, except in the very beginning, we always worked in the same room. Mm-hmm. So we were definitely across from one another. Mm-hmm. So I would get there, and if there were bookkeeping stuff to do, I would do that. You know, he could be on the phone. We would discuss things about different projects. He did a lot of annual reports. And in those period times, I had to proofread everything that was done. Oh, he only made one proof mistake, and it was his mistake and not mine.
You're confident of that.
Yes, I am confident. I did not make the mistake. That's when I began writing a seven with a line through it like Europeans do, so it would not ever be confused with the one. Mm-hmm. So there would be proofreading to do. We would talk about ideas for a poster, ideas for a project. And we worked, I would say half of the time I worked for him, we worked at Hampden Court. Mm-hmm. And then he said, I'm tired of working in the house. I'm renting space downtown. And we're going to move the whole operation. And we're going to open a gallery. Mm-hmm. Which we did on the second floor of what is now the Fraser Museum. Mm-hmm. Well, we had the second floor, and it was a huge space, okay? And he designed cases to show the art, and we had many a show mm-hmm. There. But the problem with being there back when we were, there was nothing downtown. Mm-hmm. Hillerick and Bradsby was there. Kentucky Mirror and Plate Glass were there.
Right.
But that was it.
Yeah.
We couldn't even find a place to eat. There was no Bristol downtown. There mm-hmm. were no restaurants downtown. There was no science museum. There was nothing. Mm-hmm. So we were ahead of the curve, and he was often ahead of the curve. Mm-hmm. So when Owsley Fraser decided to buy the building to house his collection, we had to move. Mm. And we moved to a smaller, much smaller.
Did he own the building, incidentally?
He did not.
I see.
He
I
did
see.
Not at I the see. Time. He bought the building, and he saved the building. Mm-hmm. The building was going to fall mm-hmm. down. Mm-hmm. He had to put in probably well over $1 million mm-hmm. to Tuck Point the entire building.
Mm-hmm. Now, he being Joyce, he being
Owsley Fraser.
Mm-hmm.
He probably got the yeah. place up to code. He probably got, I know
my,
he got
my
the
question
air.
Was, did Julius own the building?
No.
Oh, I see.
No,
okay.
Julius never owned a building.
I see.
He regretted that he never stuck his neck out and bought anything on Main Street when it was really cheap, because sure. Nobody was down there.
Yeah, yeah. So where'd you go?
We went to, it was literally almost next to Morton's Steakhouse now. It had been the Kathleen Meyer Gallery. Mm-hmm. So it was already set up as a gallery. And mm-hmm. she had given up a long time ago. No, it was Martha White. I'm sorry, her mm-hmm. name was Martha White. And in fact, we did a poster for her gallery, which is a beautiful poster. So he went in there. And then I left the business because he had gotten married, and then his wife was going to run the business, but she got tired of it and she quit. And when their lease ran out, that was it.
Then did he go back to Hampton Place?
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, I see. Did you ever know, maybe I'm projecting here, but was Julius a procrastinator? Or was he pretty efficient in terms of management of time?
Oh, he was very efficient.
So
very efficient.
No fooling around, no waiting to the deadline.
Oh, no.
Needs to be thought through some distance in advance, that sort of thing.
We suffer from high levels of anxiety. It was always, deadlines were always met. And he was always thinking. Mm-hmm. First of all, he always had a phone, camera in his hand. Mm-hmm. And As time evolved and we became digital, which, by the way, he had to learn how to do that, which was amazing. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, back in the day, if you opened my brother's freezer, you would in fact, I was out at the farm and I opened the freezer. There would be boxes and boxes of film because he kept them in the freezer, kept them fresh. Well, then everything went digital.
Yeah.
So he had to learn that. So things that he produced, like the fresh paint poster with three different colored eggs or the toe shoe on the egg, well, today, boom, 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 on a digital thing, you could do that. You could change the eggs to any color. Mm. But back then, it involved a printing process. Mm. And with the gumball machine with the fish in it, easy to do now. Was not easy to do back then.
Sure.
You had to understand printing, and he did. And all the pressmen loved him because they would have boring things, you know, to print, and then he would come, and it was always something they played around with on the press.
You know, as a sidebar, and this is outside this narrative, but as a sidebar, it would be they may have already done a documentary. It needs to be 30 minutes long, and it would be interesting to see how that was done up to the time of digital. That is, you mentioned earlier how he would go to the printer and actually stand there and watch the multi-layers of color being applied.
Right.
And that's something that I can only imagine, and it would be wonderful to see a documentary or some kind illustrating that.
Well, sad to say, the printers that he used, with the exception of the Hennigan Company in Cincinnati, he used Panair, they're gone.
Yeah.
He used Hamilton Printing, and they're gone.
They're gone too, yeah. Yeah. So this, you know, my romanticized image of a creative person is that intense, but could also get what I would call creator's block, artist block. Did you ever see a time when Julius would say, I'm stuck?
Not that he was stuck. He would have multiple ideas on how to go about something. But he was prolific.
Mm-hmm.
He just was prolific. All of his digital library, I own the copies of it. I have it on hard drives, but it's kept at Unique Imaging Concepts because they're the people who began to print things on metal. for him. He left paper, then he went to cloth, and then he went to metal. And once again, those guys, they would sit and they would play with the imagery to get the finish that he wanted.
Goodness, that's more complex than I can than I can imagine. You mentioned earlier on a tape that Julius was reticent on the phone. Is that an aspect of shy, or I guess what I'm probing here is, as people look back through his art to the creator, what kind of person was he? How would you describe him? We've already done that in terms of efficient, as far as working is concerned.
Well, my brother had a certain charm, which we don't know really the basis of that charm, but people loved to be around him. I mean, his funeral was unbelievably attended. But so he had a lot of people who would, you know, want to hang out with him, and he would hang out with some, and but his mind was always going about looking like this carpet has a pattern on it, and we may, if given a camera, take a picture of the whole carpet. Not him. He would find one slight spot, and he would shoot that spot, and then from that spot would go an entire piece of art. So he constantly, in fact, he had more ideas than he had people who hired him. And most of the people, aside from all the printing companies, he had all the nonprofits used him because the art was so good. But he had many more ideas than he had customers for those ideas. It's like the one drawback of both of us is that we aren't pushy, and we don't want to hang with the people who could get you someplace. And so for that reason alone, he would have done more work, but people didn't hire him. A lot of people were intimidated by him. They just were. And my brother did have a certain arrogance, and because he knew he was the best, at least the best here. And he also was very sarcastic. We both have a problem with sarcasm.
And so you think that might have been off-putting to some people?
Yes, yeah. I do.
Yeah.
I do. And
you ever remember an example of that?
I really can't.
Yeah.
But we were told by a professional that sarcasm was a form of anger. And perhaps we should think through before we said anything.
Yeah.
Sometimes it just, you just couldn't help yourself.
Yeah, sure.
You just couldn't.
Well, he looked the part.
Oh, yes.
Of an artist.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. And so maybe that was part of the charm, do you think?
He had that charm from the time he was young. I mean, women flocked to him. Like a bee to a beautiful flower. They just did. And I would say, with the exception of one or two people, all of his friends were women. His good friends.
He certainly had artistic collaborators.
Yes, he would collaborate with other people who
were male.
But the people he hung with were 90% women.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, he came out of a home with a mother, a grandmother, an aunt next door, and two female cousins, so he was used to women.
He certainly, you could say that.
Yes,
you could. Yeah. Did you all disagree when you were working together? Not now. I know there's going to be a break here that's going to be painful, and we're going to touch on that. But when you were working with him, would anyone get mad and say, you dumb whatever?
The only time that I got mad at him was he was out for lunch with the president of the Hennekin Printing Company. Mm-hmm. And one of the I answered the phone, mm-hmm. Images Friedman Gallery, like mm-hmm. I always do, and it was one of his ex-girlfriends. And she proceeded to read the riot act to me that I was the cause of their breakup. Mm-hmm. And when she finally, it was a tirade, I mean, it was mm-hmm. unbelievable. And when she finally took a breath, I said, I have no input on who he likes and dislikes, and I'm going to hang up now before I say something very ugly back to you. And I hung up the phone. Mm-hmm. And he came back, and I said to him what had happened, and he said, oh, she just has a drinking problem. I said, I don't care what her problem is. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you told her or what you led her to believe, because Julius could never be the bad cop. I always had to be the bad cop. I said, it will never, ever happen again. Do I make myself perfectly clear? And, and he never really took my side in the argument, mm-hmm. because years later I would see him talking to this woman. Now, if the tables were reversed and one of my boyfriends read him the riot act, I would no longer speak to that person. I mean, that would have been it. Mm-hmm. But he wasn't like that. Mm-hmm. He was not like that.
You mentioned at one point that in his relationship to women, now obviously he surrounded himself with women and seemed very, very comfortable with women friends and many, many women friends. Talk about those more intimate, those more romantic relationships. Were there many, many, many along the way?
Yes, my brother was a serial monogamist. So he would have a girlfriend for however long it lasted. And most of them lasted many years. Mm-hmm. And he would decide that he had enough, but he would never tell the person face to face, look, I think we should break up. He would behave in a way that would make them break up with him. And then he would come crying to me that, you know, so-and-so left him. He just didn't understand why. And I would just give him one of the looks, like, really? Yeah. You don't know why? And it was a pattern. And he did it. I'm probably the only one who could name every girlfriend. Hmm. But there were a lot of girlfriends. And that's how every one of them ended.
Maybe too much information. Would they tend to be live-in girlfriends?
Oh, yes, yeah, yes, yeah. Yes. They always okay. moved into his house. So the problem being that in those relationships, the woman, whoever the woman was at the time, would complain to me about him, and he would complain to me about them. So it wasn't, it began to get, for me, it began to get tedious. Mm-hmm. But that's how it worked. That's how it worked. And he just was unable to cut the strings himself. His actions cut the strings, but he never confronted the woman and said, you know, this isn't working out, you need to move out. Never.
She would have to...
She would get angry enough that she would leave. But I would say a good 90% of those women were at the funeral and maintained relationships with them after the initial
breakup.
Once they cooled down, they always stayed friends. Always. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any insight into the serial monogamy?
Well, I think he liked the idea of being in a marital situation. Mm-hmm. Now, there's someone there to come home to, there's someone there to eat dinner with, there's someone there always to talk to, mm-hmm. but it just didn't last. Mm-hmm. You know.
He grew weary, kind of weary of that face-to-face? That...
I grew weary of having to listen to each and every woman tell me things that, you know, I laughed. Like, yeah. I already know that, dear. This isn't my first rodeo. You're not the first cowboy, cowgirl, whatever.
Yeah, right.
But that's how he lived.
Huh.
I mean, his girlfriend from when he was in high school was at the funeral. He had lunch with her every year, at least once, sometimes twice. So they always stayed attached in some way, huh. in some way. And I think he needed that for whatever reason. And I think he just didn't want to be the bad guy. You know, he had a sister, mm-hmm. you know, his mm-hmm. sister, his shining knight in armor to protect him.
While we're in this window, I guess I saw in running ProQuest, the newspaper clips entering the keyword Julius Friedman, that there was a daughter, Kimberly?
Yes. Julius was living in Louisville. He started dating a woman who came from an extraordinarily wealthy family who lived here. And she was actually at Indiana University with me. We were the same age. Mm-hmm. And with all of my brother's girlfriends, they always had sex. And he believed her when she said she was on birth control. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Well, she wasn't. So she became pregnant. Well, in those days, you got married. Mm-hmm. And they did get married.
Did get married.
They did get married. I don't think it lasted 6 months. They were invited to a wedding, and he was an usher. I think it was our first cousin's wedding. He was an usher. Mm-hmm. And so he's seating people, and lo and behold, he seats his girlfriend from high school. Well, that night, she became abusive and yelled and screamed. He was having an affair, yada, yada, yada. And he jumped out of the window, and he came home to live for a while. It resulted in a divorce with him giving up all rights to the child.
I got confused. The girlfriend in high school...
He was just seating at a wedding.
Yeah.
There was nothing going on between them, but the wife thought there was.
I see.
So. Yeah.
So he jumped out of what window?
They lived in a carriage house on the second floor of her parents' estate. Mm-hmm. And so the marriage ended. Excuse me.
Yeah. Okay. All right. We paused briefly, and now we're resuming.
So they got divorced. And
He's now 20. He's now 25.
No. Let's see. I would have been 18. He would have been 21.
21. At U of L, maybe, mm-hmm. at that time. Yeah, mm-hmm. okay. Mm-hmm. When the divorce occurred?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you were saying Julius gave up all...
rights. That was the condition. And she had the last name of her mother. And none of us ever had a relationship out of respect to him. In fact, when my daughters were born, he had a hard time being around them when they were young.
Oh, my goodness. Because mm-hmm. he knew he had a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
He did not see that daughter, did not relate to that daughter, ever?
No. One of his brilliant girlfriends who had no children suggested that he should contact the girl. He didn't even know where she was. And I don't know how I did it, but I found out where she was. And I said to him, he wanted to meet with her. I said, well, she isn't going to meet with you without her mother there. That's number one. And number two, don't expect anything. But if you open this can of worms, you've got to continue this. And my daughter, Melissa, said the same thing to him. So I think they did meet. Through the eyes, she looks just like me, just like Julius. But she'd been in Louisville all the time, and she knew about him and never had made contact with him, and probably because of her devotion to her mother. Well, they met a few times, and it was not the Oprah moment he was looking for. And finally he said, I keep calling her and she doesn't call me back. And he let it drop. And I felt it was only fair to mention her. She does exist. I've never spoken to her. But it did not go the way he thought it would go. This is the only woman in his life that did not fall under the Julius Friedman spell. And I think she's it. I don't think there's another woman alive today.
The daughter did not fall under it.
And I'm sure her mother never spoke kindly of him or never spoke of him at all. But she knew who he was. And she had every opportunity. He was a very public figure.
Oh, yes.
To approach him. And he didn't. She didn't. So he never forgave my daughter Melissa for being angry with him when he stopped. In her mind, and she's a therapist today, a psychotherapist, that if you opened the can of worms, you continued. You didn't walk away unless she specifically told you, I never want to see you again, and I don't think that happened. So that particular girlfriend who came up with this bright idea was the same girlfriend who cursed me out on the phone because I caused them to break up.
I see. So your daughter essentially said to Julius, with some strength in her voice, some judgment in her voice, if you've begun to see Kimberly, even if the intensity of her willingness to see you on a regular basis, you've got to stay committed to try to see her.
Right. My Melissa was had colic as a baby for 6 months, so she's stubborn as a mule. She also felt that this was you don't start something like this. I mean, she figured maybe the girl didn't want to. She did accept the offer to meet him, but that was it.
Yeah.
And he really never forgave Melissa for being blunt about it. But Melissa was correct in this instance.
At time of, on the journey to death and funeral, did Kimberly show up?
No. No.
Okay.
She did not.
Changing the subject, when I look back at this iconic figure in Louisville, I think of kind of two pieces of two seasons of creativity, not necessarily mutually exclusive, but I see the poster artist, annual reports, nonprofit organizations, commercial companies, distribution of, and sale of posters. So I see that piece of creativity. Mm-hmm. Then I see another aspect of his creativity, and that would be the experimental art, the pushing on the edges, and that's everything from piling stones on the farm to creating more imaginative photographic imagery, to doing it on metal, to I don't know. I'm not an artist, but just looking back at the clips, I see these two pieces. Were they chronological, the one and then the other, or were they more intermingled?
And yeah, I think they were chronological.
Yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit?
He started out with doing Liberty Bank's annual report, which we no longer have a Liberty mm-hmm. Bank. He did Humana's annual report. He did Brown Forman's annual report. But slowly Liberty left, mm-hmm. was bought out, and what was happening in large corporations is that they would have their own designers. Mm-hmm. So that part of the business, and the poster art eventually petered out also. Mm-hmm. That's when he would take a job, like for instance, there's a wealthy couple here who do nothing but photograph penguins all over the world. And they wanted him to design a book, which he did. But he began to produce more and more of his own art. Like he produced the book for David Jones on the Floyd's Fork project.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
If someone came to him to do a book, he mm-hmm. would do it. But then he did his own book. He did a book of his own artwork, limited edition book. Then he did a book called The Book, which every student should look at, where he took books and photographed books, but also took pages and would like accordion the page. I mean, this is painstakingly, absolutely detailed work. And he photographed the book, and it became the book. And a guy that he admired as an artist did the the prologue to the
mm-hmm.
book.
Yeah, introduction.
Introduction to the book. Yeah. About Julius and the book. So before he died, he had teamed up with Dick Van Cleek, who had been here and was the director of the Lonesome Pine series, then left and went to Chicago and taught at Northwestern and retired and eventually came back. And the two of them hooked up again. And they were doing movies. That was his new thing. If he had lived, that's where his focus was.
Movies? What kind of movies?
Actors
or things to look, or something to look at on the screen?
Yeah, no. These were filmed.
Mm-hmm.
he did a thing called Convergence, where he took two ballet dancers and two hip-hop street dancers. They went to Angel's Envy to film it, because it's beautiful there with all the copper.
Mm-hmm.
And the hip-hop guys were dressed in what hip-hop people would wear, and the two ballet dancers was in a tutu. Actually, they were in costumes from the Nutcracker.
Hmm.
And so in the beginning, you see them dancing. Then you see the hip-hop people dancing. And eventually, you see the two of them teaching the other one the steps.
Hmm.
And they converge. Hmm. And it showed at the speed. It was probably 5 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
But 5 minutes long is just hours of taping to get those.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the direction he was going. Hmm. He was very excited.
This had to be in the last 2 years.
Yes, it was.
Hmm.
It was.
Hmm. So the two pieces, part of it was related to poster art. Which did he enjoy the most, or is that fair to say one over the other?
No, I think he enjoyed both. It's just that by my investing his money,
mm-hmm.
at a time when interest rates were extremely good, if you had money, he was freed from having to make a living. It didn't mean he turned down jobs. He didn't. But the last 2 years of his life, one was focused on the 50-year retrospective that was at the Fraser Museum. He was extremely happy about that. And they eventually bought a piece of the art he created in addition to the poster art.
Mm.
And he spent a lot of time at the Lincoln School, which is an elementary school for the performing arts.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved being around the children. They loved being around him. Mm. And his film work, I mean, mm-hmm. that's what took up his time.
How long before his death did he know that he was critically, he was on a critical path?
I got a call on June 20th, and I had just recovered from having a massive kidney infection and kidney stone, so I wasn't in great shape. And I got a call, and he said, I have a letter from my doctor. And it said, he didn't read me the letter. I should have had him read me the letter. But he said, something's wrong with my kidneys and something's wrong with my blood. And I said, I'm coming to pick you up and we're going to the emergency room. And my fiance happened to walk in the door and he said, I'm going to. So we went, and when they read me the numbers, I leaned over and whispered to my fiancé, he's got leukemia. And he said, well, how do you know? And I said, well, A, I was married to a doctor. B, I was a paralegal who read medical reports for Social Security disability. This is bad. But I didn't think it was that bad. So they put him in the hospital and transfused him. And he was there 8 days. On the eighth day that he left, they told him, finally, what it was. Hmm. And it was acute myeloid leukemia.
Hmm.
And they wanted to do inpatient chemo.
Hmm.
And he said no. He said, I want to go home and think about this. And she said, well, you don't have very long to think about it. She said, in the meantime, I want you to go down to the Brown Cancer Center and see Dr. C is his name.
Mm-hmm.
So he got out on a Tuesday. I picked him up Friday morning. We go down to see the doctor. And he's optimistic. He said, we're going to get your white cell count down. You're going to get the chemo. We're going to do bone marrow transplant. And he said, I'm giving you medication now to get the white cell count down so they can do the chemo. So we go home, I go to the pharmacy, I pick up the medicine, I give him the medicine, and by Saturday afternoon, he's violently ill. He's violently ill, throwing up. So I called the doctor, who was nice enough to give me his cell phone number, and I said, look, this is what's happening. And he said, that's odd. I said, well, he needs something for the nausea and the vomiting. So he called in a prescription. I trot out to get the prescription. So he had given him this prescription, which made him violently ill.
Mm-hmm.
That was Saturday. Monday morning, I was getting him to have a shunt put in to start the chemo.
Mm-hmm.
So I get over there Monday morning, He's still throwing up. And he said,
King,
I just want to die. Call hospice. And I said, look, you've got an appointment with the doctor. I'm calling the hospital to tell them that you will not be there for the shunt, which I did. Trotted him over to the doctor. I called the doctor and I said, you've got to see him right away. It was, he had a 2:30 appointment. He can't wait. Trotted him over. So they take the blood and they say, put him in a wheelchair, put him back in the cancer wing of the hospital. And by this time, his kidney function is very bad. And they can't do the chemo anyway. So one of the people, one of the earliest girlfriends my brother had, had a son. And even though he eventually broke up with the mother, he always was a father figure to the boy. He was in Providence, Rhode Island. He came to town. He comes to the hospital, and he says, why isn't he getting chemo? And I said, well, he can't get chemo because his kidneys aren't working. And he said, Carol, I will give him one of my kidneys. That's the devotion my brother evoked in people. And I said, well, it's a lovely offer, but it's too late. There's not a doctor who would do that surgery. And I made sure that he was on enough Ativan both trips, but increased it the second trip so he wasn't anxious. And there was a steady stream of people, and he died. It was very interesting. He had one of his male friends from high school who was a doctor, ran the Joslin Diabetic Clinic in Boston. He called me and he said, Carol, I want to talk to Julius. I said, well, Ronnie, you can talk to him. He cannot talk back. So I held the phone up to Julius's ears and he said whatever he had to say. I said goodbye. My brother died.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
So this is 2 weeks after diagnosis?
Perhaps. From July 20th to July 16th.
To August?
No.
Oh, July?
No, June 20th.
June 20th.
So August. There was 10 days left in August.
Yes, yes.
Plus the 16 days.
Yes, yes.
So it was 26 days.
26 days. Goodness sakes. One thing we haven't touched on, and I did want to touch on it, and that is, you said to Julius when he got married, it was his second marriage, interestingly enough, when he got married, that you weren't going to work for him anymore. And you had strong feelings about that marriage.
Well, what I said to him, he was 54 years old at the time. He had amassed a lot of stuff, a lot of property. He had a farm in Westport. He had the home on Hampton Court. He had all the stocks and bonds that I had gotten for him. And I knew his track record. So I said to him, we were at Jay's Cafeteria. And he told me only 3 weeks before he was getting married. He knew what my reaction would be. I didn't care if he got married. Hey, let somebody else take care of him for a while. But you don't go into a marriage at 54 years old without an ironclad prenup. And once again, him being non-confrontational said no. His famous words were to me, I'm never going to divorce her. And I said back to him, but what if she divorces you? Well knowing the track record of my brother's monogamous relationships. He did not listen to me. He got very angry with me when I said, I'm out. I'm not working for you anymore. In hindsight, it's always 20/20. I should have stayed there to protect him. But I knew you couldn't have two cooks in the kitchen. I mean, this was different. This was a marriage. This wasn't a live-in girlfriend. This was a marriage. And I left. Well, I would say a year and a half into the marriage, she calls me up and she says, you know, he's this and he's that. And I said, well, I'll talk to him. called him up and I said, Judas was very good at defending himself. I said, I don't want to hear your defense because it does not matter. This is what she perceives. You keep going down that path and it will result in a divorce. You stupidly, I always had to put that word in, do not have a prenup. So he would start flying right for a while. It happened again, said to him the same thing. And the third time, as they always say, is the charm. She proceeds to divorce him. It was a long, drawn out, ugly, ugly affair. What she had done, which if I had been working for him, would have never, ever allowed, let this be a cautionary tale to whoever listens to this. Julius owned his properties outright. She convinced him to take out a mortgage. And she got her name on both the properties. Even though he could legally prove he had owned them outright when they got married. So it was getting to the phase of they were going to court. Mm-hmm. And to reiterate about this woman is when they left, he bought her a house in Anchorage. That's where she wanted to live. Fine. I said to my brother, change the locks on the door. Did he?
This is when they broke up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he bought her a house as part of the breakup.
Mm-hmm. That's where she wanted. She didn't want to live in the same house.
Mm-hmm.
Buys a house in Anchorage, looking for victim number three. And I said, change the locks. And once again, I should have just called Willis Klein, met them there, had the locks changed. But I didn't. I thought, you know what? You're a big boy now. You got yourself into this mess. She would repeatedly come back to the house when he wasn't there. He would come home and he'd look at the walls and there'd be something, you know, something's odd. And he'd realize that she'd been in the house, she'd taken out art. She continued to do this. The locks were changed the day he went into the hospital. I said to one of his good friends who had come to visit, I said, Martha, do me a favor. Go sit at the house. Willis Klein's coming out. I can't leave him. I want the locks changed. And then I called the people that had the code to the gate, to the farm, and I said, please change the code to the gate, to the farm, which they did. So if she tried to get in either place, she could not.
That would have been some years after the divorce.
No, this was during the divorce. She was coming back in the house before the divorce ended.
I see.
And stealing.
Hmm. But clarifying in my way, I thought you said the day he went in the hospital.
No.
I misunderstood. Mm-mm. I clearly misunderstood.
This happened at least 2 years, maybe longer, the divorce went on.
Oh, I see.
And she knew he was non-confrontational.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, I should have gone to the lawyer with him. He had a very good divorce attorney. Mm-hmm. And she kept telling him not to settle.
Mm-hmm.
But he did.
Mm-hmm.
That divorce was final in December. From December to June 20th, my brother was the happiest I'd ever seen him, short of when he was a child. And so when he got out of the clear blue, there is not leukemia in our family. I said to them, he has gone through a very stressful, prolonged divorce. Could this have been the kickoff? They said, oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Goodness.
By the way, she had the utter balls to come to the funeral and sob hysterically like she was the widow.
Do you think Julius ever regretted staying in and this is my word, Loserville. Mm-hmm.
There were times he said, you know, his favorite expression is, I should have bit the bullet and gone ahead and moved away. I told you that anxiety was extremely prevalent in our family. And for Julius to get on a plane by himself to go somewhere was anxiety producing enough, much less to pick up, go to a city where he knew nobody, get an apartment, and try to get work. He could have never done it. Now he would have been much more famous, I believe. He just couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. He liked to be, I explain this to people. My brother and I always had this thing that we had to have a nest, and the nest had to be pretty. Now, he surpassed me 1,000 times over with his two nests, but it was important. Mm. And I don't think that he, just like he couldn't stand up to this woman by saying, we're not getting married without a prenup. End of story, end of sentence. And she would have said, I'm not getting married. And I would have said, oh, saved by the bell, baby, saved by the bell. I strongly suggest to people, marriage is very difficult, that whoever you are, at whatever stage of life you are, have the prenups in place, let her have one, let you have one, then you can go to mediation. You know, I already have, this is what I brought, I'm keeping. This is what you brought, you're keeping. And what we had together, we'll split that part of the pile. If you don't do that, one of my brother's closest friends who lived across the street from him, the son who Julius adored, has been going through an ugly divorce. The divorce is final, which cost a fortune, cost a lot of time. She refuses to come get her stuff from the apartment and refuses to put the car is in his name, to put the car in her name. They have been back to court 3 different times, and she won't do it. So save yourself, like this is a cautionary tale, save yourself the aggravation, you know?
Yeah. So the divorce only became final half a year before Julius's death.
Yes, she was very unhappy about that. Because had they still been in this, although he had already changed his will, so I don't think she could have gotten anything. He had changed it. I said to him during the process, for God's sakes, when you're at the lawyer, change your will. I had to, while he was in the hospital, get power of attorney, health care directive. They emailed it to me and I had someone in the hospital notarize it. Because I couldn't have made the decisions for him. Yeah. He would have had to make the decisions. And I didn't make any decision that he didn't want. It's just he was at a point, 2 days before he died, he was unconscious. And the day he died, I was there every day, and the doctor came in, and I said, look, they're only giving him Ativan, because he was not on the palliative care unit. Had he been on the palliative care unit, they would have been giving him morphine. I said, he's not in pain because he can't physically say anything to them, and I said, you know and I know where this is ending. I said, please up the morphine. And they did. And within 3 hours, he died. Now, I don't know how much they up. It could have been non-consequential. He could have been dying. But if you don't have someone, if you don't have a healthcare advocate for you, you're at the mercy of the hospital.
Yeah.
And I hate to say it, hospitals are a commercial business. The longer you're there, the longer it's going cha-ching, cha-ching,
cha-ching. Yeah.
They're at cross purposes now.
Yeah. If final question, and then a comment, and then I'm going to, this is, I have a very small addendum that I want to ask you about. But if not an artist, what could Julius have become?
Definitely not an accountant, definitely not a lawyer, definitely not a doctor. I guess it's in the same field. He would have been an architect. Mm-hmm. That's what he was going for in the beginning. He would have been an architect.
That's right. I remember you telling me that on the first tape. There was, when I did, and this is my last question, and when I did my keyword search, mm-hmm. ProQuest of the Courier Journal, Julius Friedman, I noticed that at a very young age, when he was at U of L, that he was in an automobile accident where there was a fatality.
Really?
Maybe I misunderstood that.
I have zero knowledge of that.
Oh, really? Well, I could have made the mistake, but I did want to ask about that. As I recall, the automobile accident was at Norris Place in Shady Lane, something like that, somewhere there near Highland Middle School, but I'm not sure.
It occurred, I never knew about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm not... If you've never heard about that, then I'm sure that either I made a mistake in my research or whatever. But I did want to ask about that. Okay, anything else that you want to put on this digital tape about your being very closely tied to a very creative artist?
Well. I loved my brother very much. We were alike in a lot of ways, different in some. I'm glad the time we spent working together, because had we not been working together, I wouldn't have seen him as much as I did. And I always felt, you know, there's that song from Beaches, "The Wind Beneath the Wings," and mm-hmm. I always felt I was the wind beneath his wings, that I allowed him to not have to worry about money, not have to worry about bookkeeping, not have to worry about shipping stuff. He didn't like any of those things. Mm. And it freed him to be creative. Mm. And while there are things in his life I wish he had done differently, when he died, up until that point, I had been the soldier. I'd been after the doctors. I'd been after the nurses. He was never alone, never alone. I lost it. I laid across his body and could not stop crying. And what I said to him, which is true, I said, "Everyone has left and I'm the last one here and I don't like it." So I bought two plots together. I will eventually be buried next to him. It's one massive stone. Because, like I used to say to people, I was his wife, but we didn't have sex. And that was the relationship we had. I always had his back. And I don't regret. I wasn't envious of his success. I just wasn't. I was just happy that I had a brother and mm-hmm. we were so close.
Mm-hmm. Were you as close in that makeup a year 2002 to 2016?
No. We did not see each other or talk to each other on a daily basis. Now, when he would go out to dinner with my fiance, mm-hmm. he would strongly tell him how much he loved me.
Just your fiance and
Julius often had lunch together.
I see.
And he would say how much he loved me and how much I was a huge part of why his life was like it was. And he admitted to my fiance he should have listened to me on the prenup. Never said it to my face. Never said it, that you were right. But he told Sandy, I guess he figured it would get back to me, and he did.
But not as close when you weren't working with him every day.
I regret now, after seeing what I saw occur, that I did not step back in and say, I think you need me. And he did. And he never specifically said, would you come back? And, you know, I didn't.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, like you had two lobes of lungs. Mm-hmm. One lobe is gone for me. Mm-hmm. And I feel it every day. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm doing the foundation. It's why I'm doing this, why I gave stuff to the archives. Because he should be remembered.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is no doubt, and I'm not trained as an artist, don't know art, but his work was both beautiful and fetching. Meaning, and fetching's not the right word, but it's compelling is a better word. Mm-hmm. Compelling is a better word. Certainly his poster art. I mean, I look at those images and just think of the imagination and the creativity that went into that.
Well, one thing I want to reiterate, we had a rough childhood. And by choosing photography, which is what he did, you froze a moment in time. And his work is always a moment in time of beauty. Mm-hmm. And I think that's his great gift. He did a few posters for the peace poster for Nagasaki and for the Jewish Holocaust that are not things of beauty. Mm. But almost everything else, it's a moment frozen in time. And I think that's why he liked it. You know, it was there and then it was gone. Mm-hmm. But he got it when it was there. And he could share that with anybody who wanted to look at it.
Sure, sure. Is there still a demand for what he did?
Yeah, I do. Mm. I'm meeting a woman tomorrow at where I stored all his artwork. Mm-hmm. And she is very much into botanicals. Mm-hmm. Which he is very very mm-hmm. much photographed. Mm-hmm. And was copied, by the way, poorly, but copied. She wants to decorate her husband's office with his art.
With his art.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, this is ending of a very, very, very energetic and I think very helpful conversation. Carol Seifer, I want to thank you. And this is the conclusion of interview number 2 on September 6, 2018. Thank you.
Thank you.